Is everything cool?
Everything's rosy.
Marvellous. Well, if everything's rosy, it must be time for the Linux Voice podcast, Series 2, Episode 14. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Mike Saunders.
And I'm Ben Everard.
And...
are we in the same place?
We're in the same place. It's awesome. And just like old times, we're in a pub. And also, just like old times, I finished my drink.
And it's only 12:30. Just like old times. We've not been moaning that much, though.
Not like old times at all. In this fun-packed issue, or episode indeed, we have news by Ben. We have finds of the fortnight presented by the lovely Mike Saunders.
I believe that's Graham's section, actually.
Right? Oh, well, let's share it. Let's share the love.
Okay. Sharing is good.
Speak your brains.
That's Mike. That's definitely Mike.
And there are no neurons to vocalize.
Mike has failed.
I'm going home.
Plus voice of the masses.
A good one.
Yes. We are brought to you by Linux Voice. We are Linux Voice, in fact. And
a nice little podcast.
It's a little cottage industry of a podcast. There's wood panelling around us.
Which pub are we in here? What's it called?
Well, in honour of the Iron Duke's victory over the French 200 years ago, we're in the Wellington pub in Birmingham.
First time I've ever been to Birmingham, so, yeah.
Wow! That's amazing. Yes, if you like what you're about to hear, you can subscribe to our magazine at shop.linuxvoice.com. And you can, if you want to save the trees, you can do so in electronic PDF format. We are working on EPUB.
Yep.
We've just been having a little bit of a technical discussion about the limitations of and benefits of EPUB now, but it's in hand. It's mainly HTML, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a wrap around HTML, really.
Okay, or if you're a traditionalist, you can also buy us on paper, which is mega shiny and looks great.
It looks great, and we should probably also mention that roughly around the time this podcast goes out, Linux Voice Issue 6 will be on sale on newsstands.
That's right, yeah.
And for the first time in WH Smith travel stores in
just in
the UK.
Time for people going on holiday.
Yeah. Grab a copy, and so you don't have to talk to your children or anything boring like that in your holidays.
So these are WH Smith train stations and airports?
Yeah, and harbours.
Yeah, that's the one.
Whatever else there is.
Newcastle Airport. And other airports. So it's time, more or less, to have the news, I suppose.
Ooh, right, the news. First up this month, governments and various public institutions around Europe have stopped paying Microsoft tax. It's not really something that's happened specifically this fortnight, but something that's on the crest of a wave, it seems, at the moment. It's been building up. There's been a number of fairly large public organisations have shifted to either Linux or LibreOffice or both for a lot of reasons. The ones I've got listed here are the schools in Valencia in Spain, Geneva Classrooms, and Toulouse. I think that's Toulouse Council.
Yeah, they're the ones that switched to OpenOffice, LibreOffice.
Yes. So, I mean, it's one of the things we've been talking about a long time. There's, you know, loads of advantages to doing it. And public institutions, it's even better because it's obviously taxpayers' money that are being saved.
I volunteer Mike and I going to Valencia to interview the local people there.
Or the one in Switzerland. That sounds even better.
Well, you can just drive there, can't you?
You mean you don't want to go to France?
Toulouse?
Isn't Toulouse the Bristol of France? Yeah.
Doesn't Bristol use LibreOffice as well? Bristol City Council.
It may do.
They moved to OpenOffice, didn't they? Well, I think.
Well, they started a migration program in like 2006 or something, many, many years ago.
Did they call it Brinux? Yeah, this is fantastic, isn't it? And I'd like to think this is spurred on by, you know, things like the success of the Linux project. Although, rather sadly, in Munich we have a new mayor a few months ago, Dieter Reiter, and he's already expressed dissatisfaction with Linux. He wants to go back to using Microsoft because, of course, giving all your city council money to an American megacorp is great for local business, isn't it?
They've already done all the...
Did he give any reason for it?
I think he said he was a Microsoft fan. So, and he said that Linux applications are hobbling behind their Microsoft equivalents. And You know, I imagine all he does is a few emails and spreadsheets.
Yeah, because local councils are always at the cutting edge of IT requirements, aren't they?
Exactly.
With all their supercomputers when they issue parking fines.
Yeah, he's the mayor of Munich. The most important thing he does is stabs out a tap into the beer barrel at the start of Oktoberfest. Yes. What's up, this?
So they're going to save a lot of money then, a lot of precious euros.
Well, I mean,
in Geneva and Toulouse and Valencia.
I mean, there's obviously the two advantages. One is saving money. The other is having a more flexible solution that you can tweak. Because as he says, if he thinks it hobbles behind the Windows versions, the amount he spends, he's proposing to spend on Microsoft, he could invest in developing LibreOffice.
Well, yeah, but you fund your local... When you do these migrations, you fund the local economy. This is what, when Graham and I went to see the Linux guys, they were saying an important thing is that we were not sending all this money to Microsoft. It needs work, it's a complicated job, but we pay local technology groups to do it. It funds local business. And I think, you know, the whole NSA situation is going to factor into this as well. I mean, you know...
Oh, yeah. I mean, do you have any insight into that? Didn't Merkel have a conversation with...
With you.
With Obama or whatever, and they've agreed
just
to kind
deputy.
Of neutral non-snooping clause. I mean, how much has that affected people in Germany?
A lot of Germans have been really, really angry about what's happened. But the problem is there's something in Germany called the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which is kind of similar to the NSA in the state. But yeah, so, you know, Merkel herself was like showing uproar when it was found out that her phone was being spied on. But, you know, in reality, what are they going to do? They're not going to cut off ties with the USA. So, no, I think these migrations are brilliant. And, you know, what we should probably do is gather together just a big list of all these success stories that people can use to...
All joking aside, we should really try to talk to these people because, I mean, it's I think things like this, things like the Munich piece, things like the French gendarme, who I think is still currently the biggest project where people have migrated to free software. They create like a backbone of kind of... of stability for people, for other people, for the rest of us, for other companies, for everybody else to kind of move, knowing that if it's good enough for the French gendarme, then it's good enough for us.
And obviously, it's investment in it as well. It's being used by all these companies. They're all investing however much in it. It gets better.
Yeah, I mean, when we spoke to Collabora, you know, they were getting money. I mean, it may not even be cheaper for people. In the end, they're in control of their data, and I think that's what's important. That's the joke that surrounds OpenXML or whatever it was that Microsoft rushed through. Yeah, which I'm sure will come up again.
Actually, on the OpenXML and Collabora, let's move swiftly on. That the British government have now said that ODF is that should be the standard open document format for collaboration. They gave a few. There's a PDF. For when they just want to throw data out the door.
Display, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is an open format now.
Yes, it is.
And it's, PDF-A, I think.
Yeah, it was specifically PDF-A, which was
and
the
HTML.
Open part
of
it.
Yeah.
And ODF for collaboration when it needs to be changed. And this is... It's not the first time they've said things like this, and it hasn't always been that rigorously enforced in the past. But there are sort of nods and... There's signs that this time it could be taken more seriously, and actually ODF will become the standard way of communicating with your government.
I think this is a huge story. I think it's possibly the biggest story of the year, simply because we're used to kind of British governmental rhetoric surrounding open source, but actually doing something concrete about it. I was in Portland last week for the Open Source Conference, and this was announced in one of the keynotes. It was that morning that it was announced, and there was a huge cheer throughout the crowd. You know, and this is a predominantly, a US audience. There are people from across the world there. Because everybody understands the significance and kind of the friction that you typically get from the British government in particular. You know, they're you see them as suited corporate types who don't really understand the subtleties. I don't know if you're going to read it, but some of the phrasing they used in their press release on gov.org it actually implies that they're moving away from Microsoft specifically because of their, well, they don't mention Microsoft, but they're moving away from the kind of draconian locked-in formats that Microsoft has been, which is really refreshing.
Yeah, and gov.org itself, the sort of whole web infrastructure they've built there is actually quite, it's all built on open source technologies, and it's quite an impressive, as government websites go, it's quite an impressive collection and sort of demonstration of the technical capabilities they do have.
Yeah, I'll quote directly. It says, using an open standard will mean people won't have costs imposed on them just to view or work with information from government. It's a big step forward, and I'm delighted we're taking it. That's Mike Bracken, Executive Director of the Government Digital Service. Now, what's important, I think that means that they get it.
They get
it. At least somebody there gets it.
Somebody gets it.
As long as they've got enough influence there, they've got it.
So easy, people say, oh, well, everybody has Microsoft Word. But that, you know, that's not the point. You're forcing people to buy software if you release in these proprietary formats.
And even if there are still challenges ahead, I think it means, I mean, the schools that my children go to, they use Microsoft formats for sending newsletters and stuff. And the government taking a position like this passes this kind of ripple effect down to all kinds of government and other agencies.
Can Microsoft Office out of the box open ODF files? Does anybody know?
I believe
it's a plugin, isn't it?
I thought it could, but it didn't recognise a lot of formatting.
Right, because you know, you wonder if there'll be some sort of. This could be where there's a problem that the government, all the government data is and things coming out in ODF, and people try and open them in Word, and it looks messed up, and then they complain. Why don't you go back to using DocX or something? But yeah, they've just got to explain this well to people.
Yeah, or export as PDF. If it's a newsletter, it's always insane, you know, getting it as a DocX file anyway. DocX.
Yeah, which is what a joke. Yeah, and one big XML tag full of binary data.
I interviewed the co-creator of XML last week. I should have asked him about what he thought about, you know, open XML. I didn't.
You said that without doing air quotes. Open XML.
It's Office Open XML as well, isn't it? It's even cheesy. It's like Open Office but reversed.
Yeah.
Right. Let's move on to less governmenty news and more gaming news. GOG. The gaming provider people.
Is that good old games?
Yeah. They kind of don't say that anymore. I think they're kind of trying to move away from the good old games moniker. But yeah, it is good old games.
Yeah, they're now supporting Linux. So it's in many ways, it's a competitor to Steam. It's that sort of... It's a way you can download games and play them. So they
old games?
Yes.
Yeah, so what was inspired by the kind of abandonware movement where... You'd get companies constantly trying to take down images of games from the 90s that were no longer available.
They weren't
for purchase.
Even selling anymore.
No, they couldn't sell them.
They had no way of monetizing.
So good old games came along and said, look, there's obviously a market here. They spend all their time negotiating with the publishers and I think sometimes quite complex kind of chains of releasing material just to be able to make these games available. And they do so by encapsulating it in QEMU and things like that.
I was just going to say, it must be like DOSBox.
Yes,
and
it
things,
is, exactly. And so in theory, there's nothing stopping many of these games running on Linux. And what they'd always said before was it's a matter of support. They don't want to be... I mean, just 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago, Liam Dorr, Gaming on Linux, reached out to Gaming on to good old games, and they'd said it's a matter of support. But this continued momentum in Linux gaming has meant that... they've pushed it through really quickly and maybe found it easier than they originally thought it would be. Because it's the support, and I think they're still going to support. You buy a game, they're there, at the end of an email if it doesn't work on Linux.
Yeah. I got burned with a Linux game the other week with Goat Simulator. I've got a Linux version and it's terrible.
The Linux version is terrible.
Yeah.
I don't get this with the Goat Simulator. What is it all about?
What?
Basically,
that's a real game.
Yeah, Goat Simulator. You're a goat and you just go and mess stuff up. You can attack, you can do what goats do. You can lick stuff, you can headbutt stuff, you can run and jump. You can even ride a bike.
doesn't sound very realistic game to me.
Although I can get to the bikes on my Linux version. I can only get to the bike race if I load it up in Windows, which is rubbish. It's hard to explain. I think you've got to, if you see a video, you'll probably understand what it's about. It's just a sort of big, fun, run around, hit stuff game.
I just can't wait for some open source developers, free software developers, to make a free clone called Open Goat.
Goatsy.
um, Yeah, it's that had an official Linux version. It was terrible. Even under Bugzilla, I've registered. Well, I added my comment to someone else's bug on there, but there's no response from the developers.
Is it using Unity 3D or something like that?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Where did you buy the game from?
Through Steam.
Ah, right. So as long as your hardware is capable of running the game that you buy from GOG, and if your game can't run that you've bought from GOG, they'll give you a refund.
Okay.
And they also have a similarly enlightened policy to DRM that we do, in that they don't like it and they don't use it.
Good.
So another feather in their cap and another reason to support them by buying games from them.
I don't want to. I'm not going to buy it at all. I know it just wastes so much time.
GOG is brilliant.
Yeah, I'm a huge retro games fan. And God,
Ultima 7 isn't on the supported games list. I can't remember how many titles there were. There's about 40 to start off with, but I imagine that will quickly, you know, exponentially get a much bigger list, considering most of them use DOSBox or QEMU.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on, the next item of news. Security vulnerability company made big headlines by saying they'd managed to break Tails. Ooh, it's dangerous. We can hack in. We can break the anonymity. You're all going to die. But they didn't tell us what the vulnerability was.
This is Tails the...
Am I not going to die?
You're not going to die. Well, yeah, that's the punchline. Tails stands for the Amnesiac Incognito Live System. Yeah, it's a live CD or USB or whatever that you can use, and it encrypts everything through Tor and provides you with not perfect security, but much better anonymity than you're likely to get. And it's used by a lot of people, such as the people around Snowden and people who need anonymity online. This company that finds vulnerabilities and sells them for cold hard money to governments and other people who want vulnerabilities, claim to have a way of breaking the anonymity in Tails.
How much were they asking for?
They never said. Right. These things aren't done in the open.
Because there's a related news story that the Russian government, or the Russian Interior Ministry, has offered, I think it was $110,000.
Oh, yeah,
to the first person who can identify people coming through the Tor network.
I read that as a pretty good assurance that Tails is working, or Tor is working.
Yeah.
Well, some people have turned it around and said, actually, if you've found a way of breaking in, this is a pretty good way of keeping it under the radar, that you can break anonymity to announce that you want to buy a bug.
Yeah.
So difficult that, yeah.
But back to the Tails news for briefly. It turned out the vulnerability was in I2P, which is an anonymity network, which is different to Tor and has slightly different goals. But it's nowhere near as widely used. It doesn't have as many eyeballs on it. And it was always suspected that there were likely to be bugs because it's not as mature a system as Tor. And that is why it's not started by default in Tails.
Yeah, I didn't even know Tails used I2P. And that was something else. I've read about it, but I didn't know.
No, it's got it there as an option that you can use if you want to. And it's always been a little bit, well, use it, but...
It's still very experimental, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the punchline is you're not going to die. There's not really a vulnerability in Tails unless you happen to be using I2P. If you've got it, you could always remove it.
And this story was propagated by someone with a vested interest in showing that Tails was insecure.
Well, someone with a vested interest in showing that they can break into stuff.
Right.
So, yeah. It was announced this fortnight that Windows doesn't have a majority market share in computers.
Woohoo!
So after decades and decades of being told they're 90, 95, whatever percent market share, they've now said, actually, it was all a lie. We've got a 14% market share.
Is it a rounding error or something?
Yeah.
Have I got deja vu over this? Was this somebody's
this
discovery?
Was my discovery. yeah, it was. So he, the chap, it wasn't the big boss, but some slightly smaller boss announced this in some speech, 2 or 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
And I guess only now it's come down through the official channels.
Yeah.
But they've recognised that people use tablets and smartphones and in-car entertainment systems and all things that don't run Windows.
Yeah, I mean, it's, to be honest, it's a question of what you consider the same. Because you don't use a tablet, or I don't use a tablet or phone in the same way as I use my desktop or laptop. They are different devices to me for different purposes. So I think this is smoke and daggers.
But is this a dagger I see before me? It's just smoke.
Have you still got the plastic film on your phone, Ben?
It's a new plastic film.
Oh, it's new.
It's not the original plastic film.
Right, got a couple of bubble. You suffered the whole bubble situation there.
Yeah, it's coming off a bit of the side. I probably should get some replacement plastic film.
Yeah, maybe we can crowdfund it.
Yeah, or it's like a pound.
Okay.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent, excellent news. It's now time for the round hosted by Mike and I.
I just don't know who should go first.
It's the finds.
The finds of the fortnight. The fortnight, yes.
I think I may be the only one with a genuine find.
Maybe, yeah.
I've got two pseudo finds. As in finds that have been found by other people. I'm a conduit for their finds.
Well, Ben wrote his find on his hand, and I've been trying to look at it during the news, but yeah.
It may also have been my find last fortnight. I don't have a very good memory. No, it's not. I remember my find last fortnight.
Yeah, okay, go for it.
I was connected. I was using MySQL client, and I was connected to the database. And I was typing away, doing some stuff, and I thought, oh, hang on, I want to get that command that I ran a few commands ago. So instinctively, being used to being in Bash, I hit Control R, and I thought, hang on, I'm not in Bash, that's not going to work. But it does.
Ah.
I found out that Control R, for reverse search. Reverse search works in MySQL as well. So you hit Control R, then you start typing the command, and it looks back through your history to find out the last one.
That's really useful as well.
Yeah.
There you go, listeners.
I
really
use Control
R
all the time. It is really good.
Is it part of Readline or something, do you think? So any library that any program that links into GNU Readline might have this feature. I'm just guessing here.
Yeah, I'd only tried out in MySQL, and by mistake as well, really.
That could have also been drop database or something. Controller.
Yeah, the amount of times I do Control C and try and copy stuff and kill programs.
Oh, man.
my second find kind of does build on from what I found last week and the Raspberry Pi Model B Plus. We talked about the audio and how it's actually a lot better than it was. I've actually been using my Model B Plus and the analog audio out as my main sound system. I've got it plugged in, uses XBMC, and it's plugged in through the audio in, so I can control all my sound through my phone. And after putting it through a couple of weeks of use, it really does work quite well, the sound on the B Plus.
So I go next,
please. It's your section as well, you can decide.
Okay, well, my discovery is that you can turn an Android tablet into a graphics tablet for your Linux box. So there's a sketch of Richard Stallman in the issue that goes on sale on Thursday, which comes with a DVD. We didn't mention.
True. Including Ben's respin of Raspbian, which is really, really awesome.
And just let me switch to the right tab on my browser. You install an app called a GFX tablet. It's open source on your Android device, and then you install a driver that's linked to from the website on your Linux box. And then if you've got a stylus or a finger, you draw on your tablet, on your physical tablet, and it draws on the screen. And because it works as a stylus driver, things like the GIMP and Critter actually recognize it as a stylus rather than a mouse pointer.
Ah, brilliant.
So it's a really great, cheap way. You know, tablets aren't that expensive, graphics tablets. And through doing this, I now realize that Wacom, for example, have a full set of Linux drivers for their tablets, which would keep Effie very happy. But if you happen to have a Nexus tablet or something similar, and you want to, let the kids go crazy with a stylus or their fingers drawing in Critter or GIMP. It's a really cool feature. It even does things like pressure and sensitivity. So that's my discovery.
That's fantastic. And did you say you used this to draw your picture of Richard Stallman in the latest issue?
Unfortunately, no, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I just used my mouse for that.
It's a pretty good picture of RMS.
The problem was that I didn't have an actual stylus, and using my finger didn't work very well. But having been at OzCon, I picked up a free stylus last week, so I'll have to give it another go. But in preparation for that Richard Stallman sketch, I was trying to find a stylus or something that would make it a bit easier to draw. Critter is amazing for brush models. I mean, it's still on the latest issue. I mean, I don't do any art or anything like that, but it's really good. You can just lose yourself for hours with it.
Yeah, I did a review of Critter a few issues ago, and I am the least artistic person ever, and it is really good fun just having a bit of a draw.
I don't know whether this has become a thing in graphics drawing applications or not. I think Critter might be one of the best at it, because you can choose between like an inky stylus or a paint-soaked piece of sponge, and it models it quite well in quite a fun way. Yeah, it's good. That's my discovery.
I have two discoveries.
Go for it.
First of all, I have had thrust upon me knowledge of the next Southend Raspberry Jam. So this is on Saturday, the 16th of August, from 10 o'clock to 5 o'clock.
In Southend.
In Southend, at the Tickfield Centre in Tickfield Industrial Estate, Tickfield Avenue, Southend on C, SS26LL. Talks, workshops, robots, programming, quadcopters.
Oh, yes.
And lots of fun. The lots of fun is redundant there, really. If you've got robots and quadcopters, then...
it just speaks for itself.
You're winning anyway.
Yeah.
They need some form of... tracking Nerf gun to take down the quadcopters.
Cool.
You're going to start a war, Ben.
You should go along to wherever Southend is.
Isn't it like... I'm going to offend someone with this. Isn't it out Essex Way? Is that right? Or is that wrong?
The whole of the southeast of England is just near London as far as I'm concerned. I don't really know where anywhere is, which is appalling. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, most of the people who live in England. I've let you down. But yeah, so that's where it is.
We haven't mentioned Dog Camp, have we?
No.
Oh, no, we haven't.
Is that a find?
That should be a find, or it should have been a news story, I suppose. We are gold sponsors of Dog Camp.
Yes, we are.
Which... it's taking place October
20th, the 4th and 5th, I think.
October 4th and the 5th in Oxford.
We mentioned it last podcast. Yeah.
But since then, we've become gold sponsors of the event, which is really exciting for us, which means that we'll have a stall there.
Ooh,
where we sell things. We've not really thought this through. You should see the blank faces. But we should get some stickers and mugs and t-shirts and back issues. We will do, now that I have said it, we will have to do it.
You heard it in here, listeners. If you're dissatisfied in any way, complain to Graham Morrison in person.
You could get signed printouts of your RMS picture. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll put them on t-shirts.
I can confirm that Southend is indeed in Essex. Well done, Ben. 10 points.
Nobody offended.
Except all the people in Essex who now think I could have offended someone by saying that it's Essex.
That was my find. I'm sorry, it was a red herring, but I said that I had two, but I actually only have one.
Were you thinking?
I've over-promised and under-delivered there.
This is unacceptable.
It's unacceptable.
As they say. What do I have a find that's Linux-related? Because I've been travelling for the last...
You said you've been playing quite a few emulators with your controller recently. Sounds brilliant.
That's a good one, actually. Yeah, something I have discovered that is fantastic and a use for my Raspberry Pi that sits around for a lot of the time is RetroPie, which is a script, but also, in a better form, a distribution. I think it's Raspbian-based, but it boots up straight into a really attractive emulation front-end. So for Mega Drive, aka Genesis, Super NES, Mass System, Game Boy, all the old good 8-bit, 16-bit consoles. And Yeah, so you don't need to mess around installing different emulators and stuff like that. You just copy the ROM, your ROMs onto an SD card with RetroPie, boot it up, emulation station appears on your TV in full glory. And
I saw a really good story just last week where someone had modded an old Game Boy. They'd managed to, it took a bit of Dremeling, but they'd fitted in a Raspberry Pi and wow. a new screen.
Oh.
And wired them to the original controllers in the Game Boy and were using RetroPie. And the video I watched was RetroPie. You know, you turned it on, the switch at the top, and it didn't have the Nintendo logo. It booted up to RetroPie, and you could choose the games. And two buttons, but good for lots of those games. It looked like a really good form factor.
Fantastic,
even had the battery pack in it.
Oh, really? So yeah, it was actually battery-powered as well?
The whole thing, they'd done the research on the screen and the Raspberry Pi, everything that could run effectively on the 5 volts that were delivered from the batteries.
Yeah. Well, I love this. Like I mentioned before, I'm a big retro gaming fan, and I think I'm going to make one of these for my brother for Christmas. So just pack all the old Mega Drive games into this, legally obtained, and so he can plug it into his TV and play these games without having to mess around downloading loads of random programs.
You could try and get a broken Mega Drive or SNES or something and use the case for that to hold it. So you plugged everything into the...
That would look even better, yeah. And a few days ago, Ben, you sent me an email asking if you could, with the new Pi, with its plethora of GPIO pins, ooh, if you could connect them direct to cartridges. Now,
I've only done preliminary research on this, so this could be wrong, but as far as I can tell, to connect a... well, anything, connect a cartridge to a computer to pull the ROM off it, you need the data pins and the address pins, which is on a SNES, that's 24 in total.
Okay.
There's 26 GPIOs on the Model B Plus. Now, you're obviously going to need some form of clock and probably write pin as well, or read pin. And you're not really supposed to use all 26, you're only supposed to use 24, but you sort of can on the B Plus. So it's probably, or possibly possible, to build just a simple hardware interface, basically just wire the pins up to a cartridge slot and then write a script to download the ROM straight off it. You could probably even create some sort of fuse file system. So you just slotted a cartridge in and it was there.
This would be fantastic. This is what the Retrode did, which is a device I reviewed in issue one that sadly then went off sale. But
it wasn't open source, was it? So probably they've done all of that research.
Well, it's not open source, but he said he will give the sources to anyone who wants to continue making them. And to make them, it only makes sense if you're going to make 1,000 or so.
Yeah,
but he'd have done all the hard work, won't he, in getting the clock signals right and the protocols, I guess.
Well, obviously, this has been done quite a few times because obviously, it's pretty easy to get hold of ROMs from sites. It's a done thing, downloading them.
I like the idea of playing your original ROMs, your own, and especially if you can get the saved games off them as well.
Yeah.
With the Retrode, I got my copy of Mario Kart from like 1992, and I got all my lap times from there, and I was playing them with the same joypad as well, because it had joypad connectors. So.
Were you better or worse?
I still think I'm the best with Donkey Kong on Mario Circuit 1.
15
so.
Years of Vice Beer didn't have an effect.
Yeah.
You couldn't get that data off with just the 26 pins on the B Plus because there's additional pins for the writable data. That's just for the
read
data.
Oh, okay.
However, I mean, obviously, port expanders are incredibly simple. An I squared C, it's a 10p chip. Trivial to expand that.
Yeah, well, you could start with something like the Game Boy or Master System that I assume have fewer pins, but the trick would be then connecting the metal lines onto the cartridge, wouldn't they? You'd have to get one of the cartridge interfaces or
they are available. There's like I think they're actually still being made by sort of retro game fans for repairing old consoles, but they're not that common,
right?
It could probably be 3D printed if you were sufficiently
the future is just awesome, isn't it?
The future is awesome, and so we look forward to the second half of this podcast, which is going to be in the future, starting very soon. Still to come, we don't have any vocalise your neurons.
No, sadly,
that's awesome. That's rubbish.
But then we should request if anybody wants their neurons to be vocalised on this podcast, email me mike@linuxvoice.com.
In that case, it's time for Voice of the Masses.
Hooray!
In which we ask, what was your first Linux distro? 54 comments.
That's pretty good for like one day or something.
A rich tapestry of replies. I've on the train down here to Birmingham, I compiled a few, as I want to do when I have the time, into various categories and headings. So, Voice of the Masters Chow is the top heading. Second heading is Leet. So these people are about to come. You're all Leet. You're all super Leet.
Officially Leet.
Yet another mic. The first Linux that he used, or she, was Corel Linux in 2001.
Oh, I remember that.
I seem to recall that I had an AT-based machine at the time that had no PS2 mouse ports, and my first introduction to Linux at the age of 12 or so was running through XF86 config to configure my serial mouse with the help of the other Corel Linux user on a mailing list. That's singular. Despite both of those things, I still use Linux today.
Not Corel Linux, clear.
Dan Buntu says the first Linux I had any success with was Caldera. It came free with a Linux desktop starter kit book.
I was just saying, I believe Caldera Linux. I'm going back through my memory here because I reviewed all these distributions in the year 2000. I think Caldera was the one that had Tetris in the installer, which was a great idea.
What a great idea.
I mean, the installers today tend to run pretty quickly, but back then, you know, instead of just looking at pictures of the new operating system you're installing, it was great to just play a game and get on with it.
Stefano F, sometime in the 90s, 94, 95, 96, God knows, he says, I bought the Linux Bible, the GNU Testament.
Great name.
And installed Yggdrasil. I remember trying to run X and I managed to get a black window with an X in the middle. That was it.
That's all you need, isn't it?
He then moves to Fedora Core 6 and is very happy. David the First is my first successful installation was with Caldera Open Linux in 2001, 2002 or something. It was hell. I had to listen to everything by hand.
That's why people do Arch Linux today.
It sounds rubbish. I had to find out the spec of every piece of hardware I needed a driver for so that I could manually specify the drivers, and if that wasn't bad enough, I had to manually specify the vertical horizontal sync refresh rates for my monitor. Too low, no image, start again. Too high, fried monitor.
I remember those days.
Oh, it's terrible.
I wouldn't recommend this to my worst enemy.
Because, as I remember correctly, Graham, your first Linux installation was on an Amiga and you couldn't even get X running.
Yeah, that's
you.
Right. It was like Red Hat 5 on an Amiga 4000.
Wow.
Which was lucky because it had an MMU. Remember, you had to have an MMU.
Yeah, I could never do it on my A1200.
The 040 had an MMU, which I think the 03-04000 didn't. But, it was really, really exciting the idea at the time that you could replace one operating system with another was a completely new concept. In fact, one that I still get quite excited by. You know, the idea that you can put CyanogenMod on your Android phone or put Linux on a PC when you're used to Windows. It's still a great
concept.
It's still
like brain transplant, isn't it? It's such a huge thing to do. Yeah.
So despite not being able to run X, so I didn't keep it because I just couldn't. After having an Amiga with Amiga OS, you know, Intuition, which I think is what the UI was called, with Workbench, was a brilliant system.
Ridiculously fast.
So I went back to the Amiga, but that was my first experience, and it was just a completely alien landscape, and it wasn't until a couple of years later I installed Mandrake on a PC.
So that was Red Hat 5, was it? My first was Red Hat 5.1, which came, this was 1998, and this came on a cover disc for a magazine that died years ago called PC Direct, and it said it's the operating system of the future. So, you know, naturally I had to buy it because I was an Amiga user as well, and it was clear the Amiga wasn't going to survive. So, yeah, I remember sound not working. I had to recompile the kernel for that, and the default window manager was called Another Level, which was a FVWM spin-off to look a bit like Windows 95. And it was awesome and fascinating to explore and really rough around the edges, but that was it then. I stuck to Linux.
You stuck with it?
Yeah, I just stuck with it.
X work?
X did work. I think I had 644, 80, 16 colours. I think it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about PC hardware was that, you know, they had dedicated RAM, even if it was just 4 megabytes. You know, like the S3 Verge actually ran really well on Linux. That
I had
been
of
about 1998, 1999.
Yeah.
And even the 3D component could be get working with OpenGL.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the Amiga didn't have any of that. In fact, maybe it was later when I got a Cyber Graphics or something like that for the Zorro expansion for.
Lots of the great 2D graphics, didn't it, man?
Lots of other people are saying Red Hat is their first Linux distro. What was the magazine? Was it a Windows magazine?
Yes, PC right. Direct was okay. Called Windows Mag.
LJ says, the first distro I installed was Red Hat in the late 90s. It came with a Windows magazine along with the title, The Hardest OS to Install, so I had to try it. I was successful in the installation, but was never able to connect to the internet, so I went back to Windows, tried a few others in the following years, but it was Ubuntu 8.04 that made me switch definitely. We'll come back to Ubuntu, but loads of people have said Red Hat. Seisenberg, awesome name, thank you. Waldenberg, Stephen Wheeler says, when it was brand new, I bought by mail order a box version of Red Hat 5.2. From what I can remember, the box contained three CDs and a manual. The first CD was the installation CD, the second contained the source code and applications, and the third was the archive of CPAMP, because everyone used PERD in the 90s. LJ, QChem, Espada, V8, many people use Red Hat.
I was just wafting a fly there, but
oh, sorry, I thought you were waving like when we're doing things remotely.
Red Hat was in the late 90s. It was a bit of a sort of standard distro, wasn't it? I guess Red Hat and Debian were the two major distros.
Well, yeah, you needed to get things on disks, didn't you? So you had to kind of buy or get from a public domain vendor or something like that, or magazine cover disk. Yeah, it's such really exciting times. I was living in France, and there's a Linux magazine there called Planet Linux. And every 6 months or so, it released the latest Mandrake or whatever it happened to be. It's just, I used to love updating the system.
What about you, Ben?
The first one I tried to use, I think it was Slackware. I wouldn't swear by that. It came on the cover of a magazine, and it would have been something like the hardest OS ever. And I never managed to get it installed.
I really like that as a pitch. I think we should do that with Arch, you know, the hardest Linux ever.
And that would have been, I was probably 98 or something. Then my first successful install, I believe, was SUSE in 2000. And I just remember thinking, it would have replaced probably a beta of Windows 98, I think I was running at the time. But the graphics just looked a lot better. I think it was KDE, looking back. And it was probably just that it detected the highest resolution on my monitor, whereas running a lower resolution in Windows or something like that. But it just looked really nice. And then I only had that for a few weeks, and I went away to uni, and I took the old computer from home, and I think I put Red Hat on it. I was certainly running Red Hat for a year or so. That's how I got started.
That was the olden days, though. Nowadays, people use Ubuntu.
Ubuntu?
Yorkshire Tyke. Back in 2008, after a Windows XP update stopped my dial-up internet connection from working, I picked up a special pack produced by a famous Linux magazine and installed Ubuntu 8.04, Hardy Heron. Since then, since then, I have stayed with Linux. Switching to Linux Mint when Unity was forced upon me. However, I recently installed Ubuntu 14.04 on both my sister's laptops. That's Yorkshire Tyke touches on two common threads there. First, being forced into adopting Linux by Microsoft being inept, and second, moving away from Ubuntu when Unity was released. It pops up again and again in the comments. Camarade Piotr also had Ubuntu as his first use of Linux there, which was a free ship it Ubuntu 6.06, the year when there was no 0.04.
I sent off for a ship it CD and never got it.
Oh man.
I've never really forgiven Mark Shuttleworth.
You need to contact him about this. So where is it? Is it in the post? It might still come, and then you have to install it.
Paul Walker, again almost identical. I switched to Ubuntu 8.04 after my Windows Vista died, and I really felt that I couldn't go back to it. I switched to Linux Mint when Unity came out. I tried Unity, but it just didn't work for me. Again, Mutant Albino Penguin. I remember looking at Slackware in the 90s, being fascinated by it, but seemed too scared to install it on my one and only computer. So my Linux use didn't start until Ubuntu Gutsy.
I think
The Dude, Ubuntu 8.04, Linuxister, Ubuntu Jaunty.
Yeah, I think Canonical gets a lot of flack these days, but I think there was that sort of period of time in the late 2000s with like ShipIt, and you know, they had a really slick professional presentation for everything, their website and stuff, and it did get a huge amount of people into Linux. So we've got to give them credit for that.
Well, there's another subheading here that says not Ubuntu, So Ubuntu wasn't their first Linux, but Ubuntu was the one that got them into it.
Aha, uh-huh.
So loads of people have, I mean, Mario Pinsale, in college I installed and configured Mandrake, but the big change occurred in 2006 when I installed Ubuntu 6.06. Nowadays it's Crunchbang time, but it was, who else? Les W started with Nopix. Then in 2008 I resurrected an almost dead PC with Ubuntu 8.04. Tybalt started with Red Hat 7 but really got into it with Ubuntu 5.10. Orange Dolphin,
other people, myself actually probably. I think first one I tried to install myself was Mandrake.
Right.
But there was something wrong with the X settings.
It's always that, isn't it?
Rather than defaulting to a screen that was slightly stretched or slightly squashed, it defaulted to a black screen with no graphics.
Yeah, X used to be completely ridiculous in that everything supported VGA 16. And, you know, Windows, the old Windows 95, 98, would always fall back to safe mode like this. But X, if there was something slightly off, it wouldn't degrade into 6.4.80. It'd just give up and give you a prompt. It's not very good.
No, rubbish.
You used Turbo Linux for a while as well, didn't you, Andrew? I don't know if that exists.
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
The well-known Taiwanese or Nepali or
Japanese.
Korean.
You used Red Star Linux for a while.
I just had a little bit of a play with it, yeah. Just to,
you've used all the esoteric Linuxes out there.
I've used the Herd.
Oh, well, that was a flashback to the video.
Yeah, so after Mandrake, I think it was either Ubuntu or SUSE. And I was perfectly happy with SUSE until they announced that deal with Microsoft. And that pushed me onto Ubuntu.
I went, Novell's.
Yeah, their patent indemnity program, which is still going, I think. Yeah.
That's when you switched to SCO Open Linux.
Well, but I don't really... I'm about to... My sense of inertia is terrible. I'm the absolute opposite of an early adopter. I'm using a Mint 15 and it hasn't worked properly for ages. But it just takes me so much prodding to just get around and back everything up and then sit there with it and it's a bit of a pain. And I like the way that Mint don't have that automated installer, so you aren't constantly chasing the new. If it works, you should just stick with it. But then at the point when it starts to not work, then the lack of an updater becomes subprime.
You mean like a rolling updates where you just get new stuff?
No, not so much that. The you can't do apt-get upgrade, I don't think, on Mint.
Can't you, in Mint?
Well, there's no like upgrade manager, no graphical upgrade manager.
For distro to distro releases to 16
that's
or 17.
Right,
okay.
And that's on purpose. That's to stop people just chasing the new. So if it works, don't bother upgrading.
Well, yeah, I guess they've shown this with Mint 17, haven't they? They said, that's it. We're just going to chase Ubuntu LTS releases now. We're not going to keep surprising people every 6 months. I think that's important. Stability.
It is.
Having a good, reliable environment.
SUSE says Ray Woods, Andrew Bowden, Pete Collins. Not surprisingly, not many people... not many people had Debian as their first Linux. Toei is in there, and
you couldn't,
who else?
Buy packs of Debian or official ones, could you? In the same way you could with SUSE. I had a pack of SUSE. You bought it, it came with 8 DVDs and a
massive
stack of manuals.
Loved
it,
yeah. It's like Christmas.
Whereas I don't think, at least not an official one of Debian.
You could get like CDs from like the Linux Emporium and stuff, but yeah, they'd just basically burn the CDs and put nice labels on them. But
yeah, it's Toei and Uo.
Drew, hey.
That was excellent. I know it's easy like to reminisce over old Linuxes, but it's good to remind yourself as well of what things were like.
Of how rubbish they were.
Yeah. Always struggling with X386.
Oh,
yeah.
I remember the time I tried to install Gen 2. That was a dark few days.
I had to generate mode lines just recently as well, because I've got a really cheap South Korean monitor with no EFID information in it. So I still have to struggle with that a little bit, but
I don't even know what a mode line is, but I remember looking at them in the XF.
Yeah, the time, the kind of the timing information for screen resolutions and things like that.
It's
and
terrible. It could blow up your monitor.
For all that Ubuntu is chasing a completely new demographic, trying to attract people that would be drawn to the shiny stuff to OS X and Windows 8. The work that they put in making things just work.
Yeah.
Their
installer is beautiful.
Utterly unseen and underappreciated work, but it really completely changed Linux. It made it so much more accessible. Yeah,
I mean, I think there was Nopix before that was a live CD.
Nopix.
Really made it, you know, here, just put it in your computer and try it.
Yeah.
Nopix deserves an honourable mention, actually. Yeah, Mark Johnson and a couple of others have said that Nopix was a big one for them.
And my hard drive broke, and for about 6 months I didn't have a hard drive in my computer, so the only way I could use it was with Nopix and saving stuff onto a USB drive.
you're so elite.
Actually, I had Demo Linux and Nopix, and I think they were the first two live CDs, so the only two I had. And yeah, they came with magazines, and I just, in the morning, I'd be like, oh, do I fancy Nopix or Demo Linux?
That's really cool. Yeah.
Multi-boot.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And then I sent it was a Western Digital hard drive, and I sent it back to them after ages. I just dragged my feet, I don't know why. They sent me three hard drives, it was a 100 gigabyte hard drive, which was massive at the time. And they sent me a 20 gigabyte one as a replacement. I was like, what gives? And they were like, oh, sorry. So they sent me a 100 gig one. I was like, oh, cool. Got a free 20 gig one. And then about a week later, they went, oh, really sorry you received a 20 gig one. We're sending you another one. So I've got 200 gig hard drives and the 20 gig hard drive to replace my one hard drive. I was quite happy with that.
Hopefully we can leave you with those happy thoughts now, because this is the end of the podcast.
Got to drink some beer and
need
eat
some
food.
Pint.
We do. Think of Ben's happy smiling face at his astonishing 220 gig of storage.
It's brilliant.
We'll see you again in 2 more weeks. Until then, you can look at our happy shining faces in the pages of Linux Voice. The issue 6 is going to be on sale in the UK
today. Yep.
So rush out and buy it, but don't hurt yourself. Form an oddly queue.
Yeah. And WH Smith Travel at the airport.
Yes, of
when
course.
You're all off your holidays.
And Sainsbury's now as well.
Yeah, we are back in Sainsbury's. We are
after a month's absence.
Yeah, we truanted for a bit and now we're back. So. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, that's all the weather. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.